Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm talking today to Squadron Leader Clarence Good. And it's the 2nd of June, 1980.
The early days, do you want to stop at the First War?
Well, this lead up to the First War, how you came to join the
RIC? I was saying to Bill just now before we started recording that these things like the BBC or the First War and things like that don't drop out of the clouds, am I doing this all right?
Yes, I think that's fine.
They don't drop out of the clouds. Something has led up to them. Now, having lived in both centuries, in other words, my mother used to jokingly say that I was a Jubilee present to Queen Victoria on her Jubilee. And so when she passed on, about that time, several things happened. Edward the Peacemaker, of course, took over, and he'd waited donkey's years to become king.
Yes, he did.
About that time, several things happened, and the most important, I think, was the birth, let's call it the birth of communications. That is to say that Marconi, from Perugia in Cornwall to St. John's, Newfoundland, had managed to cross the Atlantic with the letters SOS in Morse. Now, my interest began when my father very kindly took me to Liverpool, where Marconi was building another station, to meet Marconi. And of course there were a lot of side issues to all this. Years later, in a cruise in the Mediterranean, I was with his daughter, and he came to Sicily, the port of Rome, to meet her. So I met him again. But the point is that this original SOS across the Atlantic led to a tremendous amount of... It opened up great possibilities. Oliver Lodge and many famous people were... And later, of course, my friend John Logie Baird, so-called inventor of television, I was closely associated with, but that was after the First War. We're now getting up to the First War, at the time when England was supreme in its naval forces, but Edward VII and his cousin, Kaiser Bill, were, although Edward was known as Edward the Peacemaker, these two were really cousins and rivals, you see. And the thing eventually, as you know, exploded in August 1914. Now, in the meantime, what had I been doing? Well, the only thing you could do as a boy in those days was to learn the Morse code, and I became, by the age of 16, one of the fastest wireless telegraphers in the world. The Postmaster General, of course, controls all the licenses and whatnot in England, of which there weren't many, and I had my own G2OH. However, leading up to war communications business, prominent was Sir Charles Wright, and since we're speaking in Victoria, I must tell you that he was a communications expert as a young man with Scott on the South Polar Expedition. In fact, again on the side, he was the one who eventually found Scott and his partners all frozen to death in a tent in the wilds of Antarctica. Now, I became associated with Sir Charles Wright when he was then the captain of the Royal Engineers. But let us say then that there was a good deal of shuffling went on in this matter of communication, and the British government had a very secret thing called ITOC, which Sir Charles Wright, who incidentally was our neighbour here in Victoria in Oak Bay, and then when his wife died he went to live with his daughter on Salt Spring Island and died 2 or 3 years ago. Now, I used to go over and visit him, and we had a lot to talk about in regard to the very early days of communication. In fact, when I was vice president of the Royal United Services Institute, we entertained him at dinner at the Empress before he addressed the Institute and so on. And that was when we came together again, since we were now not only both in Canada, but both here in Victoria. Now then, this, this again opened up this very secret development called ITOC. And you hear very little about it, because when you're talking about that first war, you talk mostly about the size of the British Navy, the German Navy, and Jutland, and Jericho, and Beatty and his wife Dorothy, whom I knew quite well, because they lived not far from us in Leicestershire, and that's a very interesting chapter on its own, including Lord Borrowdale, his son, who was also a member of the same Hunt, you see, the same Alliston Hunt, and so on. But this was between the two wars. Now, getting back to the first war, the country having got this developed ITOC business, I must explain it to you, that what it amounted to was to overhearing a very important thing and very, very secret, overhearing German telephone conversation while the war was on, you understand, at the front in France. In fact, my people never saw me in uniform. They were in such a hurry to get to France to get this thing going. Now, I have 46 men, and this was all in the Royal Engineers.
Excuse me, what rank were you then in the Royal Engineers?
Well, first of all, you have to start as a cadet with a white band around your head, you see, and then you become a second lieutenant and lieutenant and so on. And by this time I was second lieutenant, I suppose. But it's a funny thing, you know, about technical knowledge. It doesn't seem to depend so much upon rank. Even today, in the Air Force, you can be a top. I had an air ministry in London where I served for years. You can be a top expert and so on, but have nothing like the comparable rank of, say, a fighter pilot, who in no time at all. Do you realize that in that first war that we're now talking about, Billy Bishop and people like that are prominent Canadians. The average, in fact, I've got one still living now, a great friend of mine, Don McLaren, who used to live near to me here on the island. And then when his wife died, he went to live with his son in Vancouver, and he still lives there. Now, he shot down about 56. He's one of your true Canadian aces, and still living, and probably the only one. But thinking of Bishop and people like that, the average length of life of a fighter pilot in France in those days was 3 weeks. Now, this meant that you could start at a very low rank. Bill Burkett, one of them, was flying with me 56 years ago. He lives over by the Chinese cemetery here. He's a year or two older than me, but he's still here. It was very much rule of thumb, and bear in mind the power that we had was very little. First machine I had, of course, a B-2E, my British experiment, number 2 experiment made before the First War, horsepower 60. And we used to jokingly say to Fabrice, "Breeze sprang up, you were lucky if you had enough power to get back to base." This was one of the jokes, you see.
Yeah.
Now, things advanced. We then got to 80 horsepower, I think it was, with the de Havilland, the H6, and so on. But again, the basis was communication. The British forces in France were desperate for information as to what the enemy was doing, where the enemy's batteries were, and all that sort of thing. So
I take it very little money had been spent on that sort of thing before the war.
As a matter of fact, it was hardly looked at.
Yeah.
And if you mention the politicians in those days, as politicians often are, or rather stingy about the things they ought to do.
Indeed.
See, you've got now the Adam Bowman, they don't know where they are about money and what they cost and millions of this and that. And even the Royal Canadian Air Force at this moment, which has been granted this 80A or whatever it is, costing several millions each, you see, is a lot of money. But before the First War, a penny was a penny. And if you ask the government bear in mind that Lord Trenchard, who was the army man head of the flying section, great man, 6'6", and a bit of a terror. He, of course, now is dead. Same as John Reed, who became Sir John Reed and later Lord Reed, and all that. He's another one of these 6'6", who is also dead. But at any rate, the point I want to make here for your records is extremely exclusive. I doubt if there's anyone in Canada that can say to you what I'm going to say to you now, that in this development of communication, in which Sir Charles Wright was captain of the Royal Engineers and ahead of it. The idea, to put it simply, was this: that you know that the trenches were not built like streets in Winnipeg, you know, north and south, east and west. They varied, almost like a snake, and so on. Now, if you could get two earth pins in, where an imaginary line between the two cut the German trenches, then you could overhear German telephone conversations. And that's not to say that I understood German, but we had with us, one at each post, an Englishman who had been traded in Germany or lived in Germany and so on, who spoke perfect German, understood it. And the operator, my operator, hearing this foreign language, would count the phones on him and he would interpret it and we would get the information back. Now, it's quite a little story and one could write a book about this, and I've been asked times and again to do it, but my wife says there are too many books about the war already and she won't let me write it. So the situation is that you got information back as to what they were doing. Now, the vital thing in war, especially trench warfare, is the time when you're changing over battalions. Now, a battalion may have been in its position for, say, 3 days, maybe four, and it's due for to be changed over. And so we'll suppose for the moment that the Germans have arranged for a changeover to take place, for simplicity, I'll say, at midnight. Now, by the fact that we had already got this information and they didn't know how, these ITOC sets, which, by the way, involved the first use of what you call over here tubes, we call them valves, and I took the first in use of them, the first valves or tubes in warfare in this, and well up at the front line. Now, we all know that infantrymen holding a section of the battalion, holding a section of the trenches, were in considerable danger for mini warfare and all sorts of funny mines and things that the Germans used to put up in the air, and what goes up has to come down, and when it came down it could kill, the explosive force could kill just by standing there, it could kill, not by hitting you, but up to 100 feet. It could kill you. So we had quite done about that. Now, while our infantry were holding this section, I had stations, which I used to visit each day as far as I could, along a certain section of the line held by the 24th Division. And Major General Daly, the GOC of the 24th Division, was in charge of all this. And we began in the front, in a very dangerous front, in the front of Ypres. Now then, while our battalions would change over, like the Germans changed over, but the Germans didn't know when we were changing, but we knew when they were changing, if we were lucky to have caught it. And so at midnight, when they were changing over. The whole blast, you could wait for it, because you knew in advance. You could wait for this whole blast of our artillery to blow the Germans into the air. They got dicky to that, and so they eventually, shortly after that, they decided that if the time of operation is, say, 1 o'clock in the morning, they would wait until midnight and alter it from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. And so the blast that would normally come at 1 o'clock, funnily enough, didn't come. Dead silence, just star shells and nothing happening. But at 3 o'clock, they were blown into the air. And I remember a German sergeant major saying to me, still fixed it where my headquarters were. Pardon me. I remember him saying to me, he spoke good English. He said, we can't understand how it is that if we change our time, you're still dead. And I said, no, that's the secret of the whole thing, is how you know. It's the most difficult time when they're changing battalions, is to start blowing them up. Now, this then was the commencement of communications in war. Now, prior to that, the pilots that I referred to, the reconnaissance up and down, looking for German batteries and our batteries firing and so on up and down, plus the fighter pilots who were supposed to be protecting them and so on, all this was going on. And they didn't have any means of communication. In fact, things were so bad at the commencement of the Royal Flying Corps that they will tell you that they couldn't fire through the propeller, because they shot the propeller to bits, that they couldn't... there are no machine guns on board. The horsepower of the engines controlled what you could carry by way of weight. So this then developed into a shooting match, sometimes even with revolvers, out of the machine itself. Now then, we people were interested in this communications. The next thing we had to do was to see how we could get communication from air to ground and from air to air. Now, Major General Derry, while I was busy with all this business in the front, and may I point out at this stage there was no safety attached to the job. As a matter of fact, if the infantry were holding a section of the trench, it was no good putting your pins down there. You had to wait till night time and go out as far as you could to the German trenches to put down your pins, which came back to a commutator. And you worked commutator until you got this sound of voice and clapped it on the ears of the interpreter. Right. Now, this was the was as much as you could do at that time. But from the air to the ground, the only thing you could do was to lay down white sheets in the form of a letter K or whatever. And the reconnaissance machine would look down and he would fire different coloured pistol, various like, and as to whether or not the battery that he was sighting for, our battery, had in fact found its target, and then immediately that would stop until the big, no more firing, because that would tell the Germans that you really knew where they were. This was all saved up, as it were, in a bank of attack for when they decided that should be done. This was to silence the German guns, right. Now, Major General Daly one day, I was told that I was wanted away back headquarters, and I thought to myself, good Lord, I wonder what's gone wrong. Anyway, he said to me, they want wires for aeroplanes, and they want you to transfer to the Royal Flying Corps. And this one shook me, because I belong to a spit and polish regiment with spurs and whatnot, Royal Engineers. I'm very proud of it. My father has got me this cadet commission business. And as an only son, too. I mean, it was quite a thing. But however, he said, that's it. And it means that you will go back to Farnborough. Now, to this in France, you look upon a week in Blighty as a great reward, as something to be enjoyed, to go to a theatre in London and so on. So when he said that they wanted me at Farnborough, where I first took off the ground, it happened to be in Farnborough, near Aldershot, I felt that, all right, so this was a genuine need. So my first job was back at Farnborough, was to get wireless onto aeroplanes, and as everybody knows, this was developed from the spark gap type of job, run from a battery, to run from a car battery sort of thing, to the latter part of the war, to the development of something rather more technical, which we now call electronics and tapes and all sorts of things. But they weren't then, at that time, invented. And it was between this period, the end of the war, incidentally, I received a cable from Captain Lawrence and Oswald, at this time at Farnborough, Captain Lawrence and Oswald at the Air Ministry in London, which was then at the Hotel Cecil on the in the Strand, which is now Shell Bex, if you please. I wondered what on earth he wanted. And when I got there, he said, could you leave Tyneside tomorrow at 3 o'clock? I said, where for? He said, for Russia. I said, why, what's all this about? And he said, well, there's a composite, French, American, and all sorts. We're trying to stop this Bolshevik revolution. And I want you to catch the Oporto at 3 o'clock tomorrow from Tyneside, and so round the North Cape of Norway and into the ice floes and the Arctic and God knows what. I eventually fetched down at Archangel and built a station at Bakarica and Kramagorskia and so on and down the river Dwina to Bereznicki. Now, this...
Just to interrupt that for you for a second here. This was the end of the war. Meantime, you'd been at Farnborough for what, 2 years?
At Farnborough?
Were you there for 2 years developing aircraft wireless sets?
Well, wait a minute. No. When Major General Daly sent for me, it had been 1916, 1917.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the war ended in 1918.
Yeah.
And it was about that time, as I say, that they wanted me to go out there.
Okay.
It wouldn't be quite 2 years, but in any case, we were still developing.
Had you actually mounted, installed wireless in aircraft on anything but an experimental basis? Were they operational?
We at Farnborough were responsible for establishing facts that it could be done. And then it could be multiplied and applied.
But it didn't actually happen during the war.
It wasn't until almost the end of the war that it was possible to communicate from air by wireless from air to ground.
Mm-hmm.
And pilots, by the way, had to be up to 6 words a minute. The regulation of the Royal Engineers was 25 maximum. That was the top rank. There was 25, 22, and 18 were the three grades in the Royal Engineers. Now, because I had spent so much time before the war, I was on biased and one of the fastest wireless telegraphers in the world. In fact, I slaved. It was easy for me to do 25, but to do 30. Is straining it. Your right arm moves 1,000 times a minute. If you average out the number of signals per letter of the alphabet, and you send 30 words in a minute, your right arm moves 1,000 times a minute to achieve it. You don't try to keep it up. You just get there. It's like high diving or something, you just to get there.
Yeah, yeah.
And the maximum in the British Army was 25 words a minute in the Royal Engineers. There were some very interesting asides about that, you know, because when I was called the Royal Engineers, they don't know the people that are doing the testing, they don't know who or what you are. They simply told you it's 25 22 and 18. So he said, what can you receive? I said, well, what do you send? And he said, well, 25 is the maximum. I said, well, that'll suit me. So he sent a 25 and I gave it to him. I said, now it's my turn, isn't it? See? So I hang up the key. He said, that's enough.
Yeah.
These are interesting little sidelights.
Yeah. But, okay, I'm sorry, I just want to see how far you're quite right.
But you went to Russia. It didn't amount, let's put it this way, because I was very closely associated, former Air Minister, with Cranwell. Cranwell was a very important training place where later King George VI, the Duke of York, was a confrere, you know, mm-hmm. you get mm-hmm. associated with people the same way with Edward VIII when he was Prince of Wales, used to come fox hunting with us in Leicestershire, and you get to know people. In fact, in the Second War, King George and his brother the Duke of Gloucester, when I took the first troops in history into Alsace Lorraine and they gave me the freedom of the city of Metz, came out to visit me. So we have been, I don't make any claim to be a great friend of royalty or anything of that. I just want to say that up to the present regime, I had been presented to every member of the royal family, and even at the Duke of Beaufort's place, during the Second War, when Queen Mary was living there in Wiltshire. I was presented to her and so on. But when Prince Philip was here, I had a lunch with him, and his last visit, I was with him at Government House and so on. So that they do in a way know me, although I'm of no importance. I mean, we come together on occasions, and that was one of them. Now, the big point now, of course, from the forces, point of view of the forces, is what happened between the end of the war and the beginning of the next.
Oh, well, if you wouldn't mind going back and telling me what you did in Russia, you established these radio things down the river.
I was the chief under the Tsar. North Russia, at Gorka, had a station built by Marconi, which I took over. And Captain Lawford Oswald Davis, who said, you were the chief communications officer for the whole of this force. And the only communication we had between the whole of that bunch, Archangel Bakaritsa and Ishkogorka and all this area, pardon me, the only communication between the forces in Russia, the composite forces, was with Aberdeen, you see. So the British Parliament under Lloyd George, it's funny, you know, about war, that parliaments go into a tizzy. They can't get you fast enough when there's danger, when there's a war about to break out or has broken out. But as soon as it's over, they don't give a damn. And somebody in Parliament stood up and said something about these people in Russia, and some other idiot said, Russia, where's that? You say, oh, well, with troops, all right, well, we'll fetch them all back, and so on. So we got the next instruction to destroy everything, if you please. I fly here in what we call Big Axe, Armstrong Whitworth, great big sort of small bombers,
mm-hmm.
and so on. We had base out there, we were told, as a matter of fact, I finally finished up with a clock at home with a four-bladed propeller with the blades cut out. And so on.
Oh, yeah.
You're told to destroy everything. And you'll find yourself back in England. Now, this is where I spring the gap between the first war history, to the commencement of the BBC. Now, at that time, there was a lot of visionaries who could see that something, you know, there was something in the future. And one of them was John Lurgy Baird, the third floor up, Greek Street in Soho. I became associated with him in the development of television as it was then, and that was the transmission of a doll or a figure from one room to another, three floors up in the Drake Street, South West End of London. But you see, that was just the sort of beginning, and then eventually Marconi at Chelmsford developed the electronic camera, you see, which revolutionized the whole thing, so that now you could get by the use of the electronic camera, you could put up a screen, get a picture with a division, not of 36 lines, but 450, if you please. And so now, by the re-entry of vision, you think, when you go to the cinema, or you watch your television screen, you're given the illusion of movement. But in point of fact, as you know, each one is a separate picture. And it's the retentivity of vision that gives you the illusion of movement. But in point of fact, as you know, a 35mm, as you go to the theatre, each one goes through individually.
Yes.
And they have a rotating blade with slots in it, in front of it, to cover the change from one slot to another. So this was silent films. Then came Al Johnson, one or two things like that, very early days, 1921, that you could now hear sound in a cinema. You see, it's no longer a silent film, you could hear sound, voice and so on. So that development was running alongside the main development of communication in warfare, the sonic boom and all that sort of thing, and the Navy feeling for submarines and so on, were all very interesting, all very, very linked together. Now, it was decided by 10 firms in England who were making radio crystal sets or something, that there should be a governing body, and it was the BBC, and there was an engineer in Scotland named John Reith, and they brought him down, and he called himself, he had some very big titles, he called himself Director General, and he said, I was called, you see, and he said, now, in view of all your experience, you wanted to come in. And he said, I want you to develop the West. That's how you get this film here from Ben Gilly and so on. The Great West, I went to Plymouth. It's without going into too much detail, I just got a first-class ticket to leave Paddington, and I'd never been to Plymouth before. And they booked me rooms at this most expensive leading hotel, the Empress, you might call it, of Plymouth, which was the Duke of Cornwall Hotel. And I landed there, and from the ground up, with nothing at all, but the authority to develop. So I found a couple of chimneys up, and I said, what are they? They said, that's the sugar refinery. So I sent for some Steeple Jackson, said, I want an aerial hanging between these two. And we eventually got cracking. And I had to do something. I advertised in the paper. And amongst those who applied was Gene Tye, from Edinburgh University, who was visiting her sister, a doctor's wife, in Plymouth, and she decided that she'd like to stay. Her sister, and she became my secretary, and we built it up from there, with Jimmy Langham, Captain James Langham, as my assistant. One of my visits to directors' meetings in London, they asked me, they said, we've got a fellow named James Langham, could you take him? Because he's married to a doctor's daughter in Yelverton in Devon. It did all fit in very nicely. I said, oh, well, I'll try him out. I tried him out and kept him. The interesting part of that is that we had set the seed in the First War of communications between the forces, between aeroplanes, between the The Air Force and the Army and the Navy, and naval ships at sea and all that. And so, alongside the civilian development of the British Broadcasting Company, was also the services development, do you see?
Mm-hmm.
So that it was quite something.
Were you involved with the development of any service, wireless communications between the wars? Or were you exclusively with the BBC?
Yes, I was. But you see, I've been through a great deal, which I haven't mentioned, and I don't wish to, that you don't get blown about the way I was, without in warfare and so on, without it taking its toll. And Colonel Nixon Biggs, the Holly Street Specialist Chairman of the Irish Commander, were all put me in a hospital for 3 months, his own private hospital at Finchley, when I got back from Russia. And then they wanted me to fly out to Egypt. They said, nothing to it. And so he said, there's only one thing for you, and that's to go back to Leicestershire and get amongst your horses, get your strength and health back. Which of course I did, so they invalided me out. But the enemy, I was always associated with them. They never really lost me. You see, I was always attending their dinners and all this sort of thing. So when it came to 1936, and Hitler said some nasty things to Chamberlain, Air Ministry brought me back. That was a very unusual move.
So you actually were re-enlisted, in fact,
yes.
Or brought back to the Air Force.
I'll tell you how strange this situation was from the point of view of war, how delicate the situation was between Germany and Britain. Because Hitler had got a tremendous following by this time. By the time of Munich, and always walking into different countries and saying, this is mine, didn't seem to suit very well with us. And we took a very poor view of it when we discovered that Hitler said to Chamberlain, I have 10,000 bombers, I'll lay London flat, I will occupy Britain, and I'll take our able-bodied men to build roads in Germany, and my men can do what they like with the old women. Well, now, some of them, we fox-hunting chaps and so on, we took a very poor view of that. We thought, well, the hell, we might as well lose everything and fight for it. I sit here and wait for it. So we did, in fact, get, we did, in fact, do something about it. And the strangest thing of all is this. The Air Ministry said, unfortunately, we can't put all this in the Royal Air Force development roster, because Hitler will then say, you see what they're doing? They're building up for war. We are entitled to go to war against them. They're building up for us. So it was all, not only was it secret, but it was ultra-secret, and the whole damn thing had to come down. Now, in the meantime, that private development that I referred to, private ownership licenses, what you now call ham stations, had developed. And the sons of pretty well-off people, wealthy people, had got their own stations.
Mm-hmm.
Now, they then said, well, we've got to give you a title, so we'll call you Air Ministry Regional Controller for the Midlands, which of course went from Wolverhampton to Birmingham to Derby and all over, and I used to call them together. Now, for 2 years before the outbreak of war, I never went to a theatre. I was on the air every night for 2 hours from my own station with these people, all in secret code and so on, developing and ready. And a week before the war...
What was this communication all about?
Training for this very thing.
Oh, I see. All right, yes.
Training right. For what we were going to do.
Yes, right.
In the war.
Right.
Should it break out? And there was a very close feeling that it would break out, in spite of what Chamberlain said. It came back with a bit of paper and peace and all in our time, and all that. Oh, we didn't believe it.
Yeah.
So, the...
A week before the war broke out, you were going to
yes,
say.
A week before the war broke out, the Air Ministry said, gather your boys together. I sent cables to all of them from Grafton Street. Come to Grafton Street in London, And you, there's one rule about the forces, as you and Professor Roy and everybody know only too well, that you can't take people into the forces unless they're passed medically. You see, or got a grading, you've got to do that. So they were rushed at 2 o'clock in the morning there. Doctors and so on were going through these men of mine, you see, and I finally got them. Now then, they said, you're going to take them, their factory uniforms in their bags, and you're going to take them in civilian clothes as tourists to France. And you, when you get there now, you can work it out how you're going to cover British Expeditionary Force in France, because what will happen is that Germany will fly around Denmark and Holland and attack us from behind. So now all this has got to be covered by you and your men. Sorry. Now let me tell you, this time one thing we discovered which shook us rather badly was this: that from the point of view of the cooperation of the Air Force and the Army, we discovered that the French took about 20 odd minutes. Mind you, hurricanes are about 400 miles an hour. About 20 odd minutes to get information from the front that the German Air Force were actually attacking us, were coming over. And so we didn't think anything of that. And this communication of mine, I said to my men, now listen, if this information, while I was Air Minister during that period, 1936, the outbreak of war, I developed the Terry system of aviation plotting, which enabled my boys to get very quick information as to where these machines were and where they were going. And I told them, I said, if your time from the front, and there was some radar too, that again was extremely secret, but let's talk about wireless. If your time from the front to the squadrons exceeds 30 seconds, you won't hear anything from me, I'll be satisfied. They actually got it down to 17 on one occasion. 17 seconds from sighting the aircraft from Sergeant Messerschmitt to scrambling. Another bit on the side, forgive me drifting and all these bits, but another thing on the side was that we got information later that Hitler said there must be something wrong. And my underground tells me there are only 2 squadrons in France, number 1 and number 73, the ones I'd taken over on the day war broke out. And yet he said every time we put a Messerschmitt in the air, there's a hurricane there to meet it. And very shortly after that, the Spitfire, an extra 40 or 60 miles an hour, whatever it was, or 40 or 60 more horsepower, so much faster, the Air Ministry put out a dictum that nobody over 30 was to be allowed to fly them. Gee, we're so serious with Spitfires that it couldn't be. We even lost Cobber Cain, the New Zealand ace. Wonderful fellow, yes. Advanced Air Striking Force in RAS, Reims, R-H-E-I-M-S, Champagne Aerodrome. And then when the Vichy government, of course, collapsed and cooperated with the Germans, I had to fly from Champagne Aerodrome at RAS to Croydon, you see. These are the things that take place. Now then, that development, which you might call civilian development, military development, and so on, of communication, is now even taking an increasing part in the prosecution of war. And the development of the atomic bomb and the hotline and all this sort of thing, and pressing buttons and whatnot that you hear talk about between Carter and Khrushchev, has altered the old-fashioned outlook on the development of war, because it's so catastrophic. I mean, after all, if you drop another bomb, it wipes out your organization, you see. So that how it will go now, it is difficult to say, except that with the development of television and the increased equipment in our naval ships, as you see here from Esquimalt, and the increased communication, even taxes, if you please, now can talk to each other and so on. Everybody's got it. You see, there's no novelty anymore. It's only now a question of sensitivity and distance and development, you see.
Yes, right.
That's what it is. Yeah. I mean, for instance, all that struggle that we went to, or Marconi did, in the first year or two of this century, to get SOS across the Atlantic. I mean, from Bulger and Cornwall to St. John's and Newfoundland. I mean, it's baby talk today. I mean, I can, even from the top of Snowdon, 5,000 feet, on 5 meters, we were carrying out those experiments between the time of the end of the war and the beginning of the BBC. Anyway, that's the reason they sent for me, because they knew who I was. Now, one of the conditions of the BBC appointments in those days was it had to be 50-50. You had to be 50% technical to be able to put things right on the spot, you see. Because they were short, and there were 10 phones putting in 10,000 each, £10,000 each didn't go very far. We were working on a shoestring in the BBC to begin with. And until the government coughed up some money years later, but in those days, we had to have 50% technical and 50% musical in order that you could develop the programmes, you see, the broadcast programmes. And this is precisely what I did, because I had, for my sins, to play the violin, and I understood music. London College of Violinists and so on, you see, passed the exams and so on. So that I had this musical background, but essentially this technical background. And that was how I was able to develop an amazing history. These films here, well, sometime when you've got to listen, will tell you what sort of development it was. The first broadcast of almost everything. The first broadcast in the States, the first broadcast in the church, the first broadcast to sea, the first broadcast to birds, the first of everything ran from my station, which of course created tremendous jealousy in London.
Yes.
You see? I mean, take Lady Esther, a member of Parliament, the only woman in Parliament who represented Direct Division of Philip. And I said to her, now I'd like you to come and say your piece. And she said, frightened to death, she said, they've asked me in London, I refused. But when they heard in London that I'd actually got her, you see, the Queen of Romania was staying with her at the time, I got her in too. And the Prince of the station, I held her hand while she spoke and so on. And she was kicking away at the microphone and so on, frightened her. But I did it. And it was these things that caused such tremendous upheavals in the upper echelons in London. It didn't bother me any. Because I could always go back to Leicestershire fox hunting. At the end of 2 years, I resigned. You see, I went to the director's meeting up in London, I saw Reed, and I said, I've done as much as I can for you, I'm resigning. And Jimmy Langham, this Captain James Langham I told you about, he took over for a while, but of course he was no organizer. He just ran the show for a bit, as it was, as I built it. But these are the things that cause me now in my old age to ponder. I can put all this down in history. You hear all this stuff that the BBC wants, sending out the crew and all this to for a couple of hours on videotape and broadcasting all over Britain and so on. It's the sort of thing that they're rather proud of, you see, as history. But the problem will now develop In the forces, as you can see with these tanks and things, they go Victoria Parade, artillery and all that sort of thing.